Welcome to the Junk Refund Show, hosted by Alan J. Cook, founder of 1-800-JUNK-REFUND. Have you ever paid those expensive junk removal companies to take away some of your stuff? Only to say to yourself, as a truck drives off down the street, some of that stuff wasn't junk. Did they try to sell it for you and give you some money back? No. Well, now there is a company that can do just that. Listen to our weekly Junk Refund Show on BBS Radio TV to learn how one lady spent $375 on junk removal and got $3,200 back. 1-800-JUNK-REFUND represents the next generation of junk removal. Learn how to not only save your money on junk removal, but how to get some money coming back. Plus, purchase one of our radio vouchers during the show to save even more on your junk removal. Let's get the junk out of your home and out of your life. Now, with your host, Alan J. Cook.
And welcome to my favorite time of the week, Thursdays at 3. I just love how that rolls off your tongue, Thursdays at 3. Eastern time for the Junk Refund Show, the longest running junk removal radio show in the country, perhaps on the planet, perhaps in the universe. We'll get back to you on those last two statistics. But anyway, we're having a lot of fun here just talking about how to get the junk out of your home and out of your life. And today's guest, who will be with us in maybe 10 minutes or so, 15 minutes or so, is a gal named Kayla Sanders, who has written a book called Mojada, M-O-J-A-D-A, which means wet, and hence is the term for wet back when you talk about immigrants who cross the Rio Grande River into this wonderful country. Kayla is a friend of mine from the church that I go to here in Washington, D.C. Her husband, Mark, is a very good friend of mine. And Kayla made the decision as a 15-year-old Honduran resident to try to get to the United States for a better life. And that's all I'll tell you at this point, but you want to stick around for this story because it's an amazing story about how some people basically left some of the junk behind in their life. That is not a slam against the country of Honduras or anything, but she just wanted a better situation and took on the 1,600-mile trek to make it to this country as a teenager, and she made it. And her story is a remarkable story, so I'm thrilled to be able to have her on the show. So stick around for my interview with Kayla Sanders. She's quite an amazing lady, a young lady, and has done some terrific things in her life. I'm sure you're dying to know, so what's the junk removal guy been doing the last few days? Well, let me tell you, you're familiar with Macy's department stores. They are closing some of those stores in the Mid-Atlantic area, and one of those is in Dover, Delaware. So on Monday afternoon, we took off to Dover, Delaware, me and another guy, and it's a two-hour drive east from the Washington, D.C. area. And went there to basically pull a bunch of large, heavy metal racks out of their showroom floor. And it was on these racks that they kept all their inventory in an amazing system that is all done through barcodes and everything. Those racks are 8 feet tall. They each weigh 200 pounds, and there are 840 of them. So you do the math. It's 160,000 pounds just if you have 800 of them. And in 2 days, we probably got rid of about one-eighth of them. You can put eight of those suckers, which is the right word for these things. You can put eight of them. If you lay them down lengthwise, you can put eight of them into a 16-foot Enterprise rental truck, which is what we took with us. And thank God it has a lift gate on the back, which lifts this 200 pounds up into the truck. So Warren and I didn't have to lift it, but we just had to arrange it. On the on both ends of these platforms or these I want to say bookcases, that's not it. Anyway, on both ends of these suckers, there is exposed rods of metal which run along the four corners of these books, of these shelves, these shelving units. And the metal sticks out about a foot to a foot and a half on both ends. So as you're playing with these and flipping them around and throwing them onto a truck or throwing them off of a truck, these suckers are so heavy that you better be careful and you better watch where your head is, or one of these things is going to flip up and hit you and basically cut you, you know, quickly because of their sharp edges. Warren and I were fortunate enough that in basically a day and a half of doing this, or 2 days of doing this and moving maybe 100 to 120 of them or something, we were fortunate that nobody got cut. We had a couple of close calls, but no blood. And so we thought that we were quite fortunate. We felt pretty watched over in that regard, and probably made, I don't know, $1,300 or $1,400 or something, taking this stuff over to a local scrap metal yard in Dover. Scrap metal, by the way. And everything worked out well. We had a little hiccup along the way where some other people came in and basically pulled into our slot that we had been working at to an exit there at Macy's, and basically took about what amounts to probably, I don't know, 1,500 pounds, maybe close to 2,000 pounds of metal that we had pulled off the shelves and thrown into a bin so we could take it over to get money for it the next morning. And they claimed that they had done all of that, and they didn't. They stole it from us. They really stole it from Macy's. But anyway, we filed a police report and yada, yada, yada. But the bottom line is that we couldn't really do anything because they were let in by an employee who really didn't have the authority to let them in, but still somebody let them in. And they said, oh, hey, look at this stuff. It's all ready to go. Let's throw that in our pickup truck. And they did. And when I confronted them on it, I was lied to about six times. Which, you know, is kind of easy to detect, but we just moved forward and did our best. So with the exception of one small hiccup, we drove back home last night. I'm leaving in about 3 hours to go out to Los Angeles to do a junk removal job out there on Friday and Saturday. And then if all goes according to plan, I head south to the San Diego to see my awesome nephew who's down there. And he is going to give me a tour on board his, well, it's the country's, but he knows how to drive this thing, a nuclear submarine that is stationed there in San Diego, that he has gone out on for the last couple of years and sailed the Pacific in this nuclear sub. So that's my Easter weekend. I'm kind of excited about it. It should be a lot of fun. I'm just thrilled that we made some money going to Dover and that nobody came home with, you know, a bunch of cuts on their hands or legs or faces or whatever. And hats off to the nice people at Macy's who needed some help getting a bunch of these out. And we went over and did what we could, and it worked out well. So we now have Macy's department stores as a customer, and that's kind of fun. And that's worked out well. So I am very excited to talk to Kayla today about her adventure, and I'll compare my life as a 15-year-old with her life as a 15-year-old, and you're going to hands down say that she had the tougher life and has the more exciting story. In other junk removal news, we're out here just south of Baltimore. I'm maybe 45 minutes south of Baltimore. You all know what happened to the Francis Scott Key Bridge, which got hit by the tanker a couple of days ago, and six people have lost their lives. They have recovered two of the bodies this morning, a couple of Hispanic gentlemen that were in a red pickup truck on the bridge when this tanker hit the pylons. And thank heavens more people were not on the bridge. I think it was like 1:28 in the morning. You know all about this because it's been all over the news. But today is opening day in about an hour, I think about an hour, opening day for the Baltimore Orioles in Camden Yards in Baltimore, and they are going to have a moment of silence for the families of these victims that lost their lives, and others that have been injured. And so it is a very somber, delicate day today, and it's been the case for the last 48 hours or so in the Baltimore, Maryland area. This bridge is a key bridge, no pun intended there, but it's a key bridge for traffic going up and down the East Coast. It's the waterway is a key waterway for shipping. It's one of the largest harbors in the United States for automobiles to be shipped in and out of. I can't remember how many people, I want to say 8,000, but it could have been a much higher number than that, that are involved in the importing, so to speak, of goods and transporting of goods and working on the docks up in the Baltimore area, whose jobs right now are kind of on hold until they get this kind of more figured out. But your heart goes out to the remaining four people that are underwater and are not accounted for, obviously presumed dead because of the time frame that's elapsed. And it's a somber day for the people in Baltimore. So remember our friends up in Baltimore in your prayers tonight, and ask the Lord to bless them in any way that he can. It's been a tough couple of days up there. That's just life sometimes. It's just what happens, I guess. But hats off to the first responders and all the other folks who got involved in this, stopped the traffic so more people wouldn't be on the bridge when it collapsed. And man, is that one big tanker up there that has hundreds and hundreds of cargo boxes, we'll call them, loaded on its deck. That's a massive ship and a massive amount of weight. And how in the world you stop that thing when you've lost power? You can't. I mean, it's like, watch out. It's coming and there's not a darn thing you can do about it. So anyway, that's been a big topic in the news that is kind of a local situation for us out here. And my thoughts and prayers go out to the families of the victims and anybody involved. And my thanks to the first responders and to the whole community up there who, and even the federal government getting involved in trying to make this a little bit better and take care of this tragedy that's happened. Other news, a quick shout out to a cool guy named Charles Robbins. You should Google his name, Charles Robbins. He is a political fiction writer in the Washington, D.C. area. And we went in and helped him with a project that was just fascinating. I don't want to tell you too much about it because he'll obviously want to maintain his privacy, but he's written a book called The Accomplice. And we went to his place, helped clear out some stuff. We've put a bunch of stuff up for sale, and he gave me an autographed copy of his book, which I thought was pretty cool. And so you never know who you're going to run into. He has, you know, pictures of some of the top political leaders in the country on his wall, you know, with autographs and telling him what a great guy he is and stuff like that. And he just has some wonderful stuff that we have hauled away that Daily. I delivered about 2 hours ago a couple of end tables to a lady in Fairfax, Virginia, who bought these for $250 and then paid us $50 to run them to Fairfax. I literally did that a few hours ago. And these things they look like square shipping crates with rounded corners that have the leather handles. They have two drawers in each one of them. You know how people get excited about these older shipping crates that have the leather handles on them and they open up and they kind of sit flat on the floor and they're horizontal in shape and stuff like that? These end tables are like taking one of those regular shipping crates and cutting it in half, putting two drawers in each end, and then rounding off the corners and closing it back up. And they're just really classy items. And when we put these up for sale, it didn't take long for a bunch of people to get really excited about it. That shows you how much class my friend Charles has. He just has class through and through. And I think it's okay to tell you, he purchased a unit in a large old apartment building that has since been condominiumized. He purchased a unit there. He said it looked like a bomb went off before he got involved. And so the prior owner was doing some remodeling and I guess didn't finish it, may have passed away. I can't remember for sure. But he said it looks like a bomb went off in here. So Charles goes in and buys the thing and gets a great price on it. And then goes to work and fixes this up and now has this awesome, well-decorated, immaculate, incredible place. So thanks to my buddy, my new friend Charles Robbins, for giving me an autographed copy of his book, The Accomplice. And he's a very good writer and a very smart guy. And I am just having a blast reading his book and enjoying every minute of it. It's kind of like, you know, here's what happens inside of Washington when you're a, you know, legislative aide and, you know, various people are running for president and whatever. Gives you some good fictionalized insight into what that might be like. And I think if somebody would know that, Charles would be the guy. So, okay, sounds good. All right. They just let me know that Kayla is going to be on the line here with us in a couple of minutes, and when she gets on, we're going to take off with a escape from not escape, but get out of Honduras and get to the United States freedom story from a 15-year-old girl, which she's not 15 now, but she has a wonderful story, and I'm just really excited to talk to her about it. So make note of The Accomplice, a novel by Charles Robbins. If you want some good deals, you might check out the Macy's stores in your area. They may be having some good deals right now. I don't know what extent they're going to be closing some other stores down, but this is the second one that we've been made aware of in the Washington area, and we were happy to help them out. And keep in mind, the thing that sets us apart is that we take the good stuff and we put it up for sale, and if it sells, you get some money back. So Charles, in this case, we sold his two end tables for $250. He gets 35% of that back, which is probably $85 or something like that. And so he's going to make some money, plus get his place decluttered because 1-800-JUNK-REFUND went in and made it happen. Not to pat our own backs, but every once in a while, hey, you know, it's okay. Let's see, what else to tell you? Keep in mind when you're listening to the show, and if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can buy a voucher by calling the station during the show and just leave them your name and number with Don, our wonderful producer. The number is 888-627-6008. And all you do is call in and leave your name and number. Don will forward your name and number to me afterwards. I will send you a link that allows you to buy a pickup truckload of junk removal that's normally $229. You get it for $79. It's the lowest price that we make available for junk removal. Even our Groupons, which we've done thousands of jobs with Groupon, that was the lowest thing we had available. That's $99. It's still available. Cool. And you can call the show and you get one of these radio vouchers, and it is, it's a great deal. Kayla, how in the world are you? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you okay. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine. Yes, yes. We love having you on the show, and thank you for taking the time. I know your schedule's busy, and you've got a lot going on, and we just love getting you on the phone to talk to you about your book and some other things going on in your life. So I think what I'm going to do is we're going to take a break for about a minute real quick, and then we'll come back, okay. And we're going to launch into your book and your story, and I can't wait to have you tell us more about this. So
okay.
we'll be back with Kayla Sanders in just a second. See, this is a really easy interview, Kayla. You show up, you get on the phone, and immediately we give you a break, right? So that's kind of how we work here. Anyway, we'll be back with this fascinating lady and her doubly fascinating story in just a minute. You're listening to the Junk Refund Show with Alan Cook, coming to you from Washington, D.C. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Have you ever hired one of those expensive junk removal companies, then wondered what they did with the stuff? Especially the good stuff. At 1-800-JUNK-REFUND, we junk the junk. recycle stuff like metal and wire, donate items and get you receipts, and put up for sale the good stuff. And if it sells, you get some money back. Cynthia paid $375 for junk removal and got $3,200 back. Would you like to know how she did it? Tune in to the Junk Refund Show with your host, Alan J. Cook, every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time to get the junk not only out of your home, but also out of your life.
Thank you. This is Alan Cook back here with the Junk Refund Show, and I'm really excited to introduce my friend Kayla Osiris Sanders to you, who I've known for a few years, and I'm a really good friend with her husband, Mark. And Kayla has written a book called Mojada, M-O-J-A-D-A. And I'm just going to let her tell you some fascinating stuff about this book. Tell everybody, Kayla, why you named the book Mojada.
I named my book Mojada because it's a word we use as the Latin American community who migrate to the U.S. without documents, without a visa, and it's a way to describe how you enter the country. Now, when I originally thought about writing Mojada, that's the first thought that crossed my mind. I'm going to name it Mojada, which is the female form of Mojado. Mojado would be the male. But then as I wrote the book and as I finished it, I understood the meaning, a bigger meaning behind it, and the reason why Mojada exists and why I wrote it is because I want everybody to know that we in the world are all mojados. We sweat, we are wet, and that's the translation for mojado, is wet. And we are all here facing our challenges and trying to dream big, and we're sweating and we're crying, and every day we're trying, so we are all mojados.
That's a great answer. Now, your younger sister, is it Gabby? Is that her name?
Yes. Her name is Gabriella.
Gabriella. How old were you and Gabriella when you decided to try to immigrate from Honduras to the United States?
My sister was 14 years old, and I was 15.
What made you decide to take on that task?
We were in Honduras by ourselves. All of our family members had migrated to the U.S., and my sister and I were the last ones to stay back, and we didn't have anyone to take care of us. So we wanted to be reunited with our family, and we started our journey, you know, as Mojadas.
And I guess they can't just put you on a plane and fly you to the United States and then everything's happily ever after, correct? There's more to it than that.
Yes, it's not that easy. Getting a visa is almost impossible for someone with low income or few resources. Even if you have them, you are not, you know, guaranteed that you're going to get a visa. We actually tried to apply for one when we were younger, and we were denied. And at the time, we were teenagers, and before we came, my family, who were in charge of us, my aunts and my grandmother, who raised me, they all thought the best way to get us here was through land with a coyote.
How long did it take you from the day you started this journey in your hometown until you were safely across the border? About how long did that take?
I started the journey around November 24th, and I made it safe home to my family January 26th.
It took about 2 months.
It was 2 months.
What was the toughest part of that trip?
There were so many parts that I will never forget. And one of them is feeling lonely, not having someone to cry to, feeling like I had to be strong, and feeling like, you know, I have no option. I can't go back to my country. I have to keep going. I have to I have to laugh. I have to have faith that I can make it. And that's one of the toughest part on my trip, I would say, during this 6 weeks or 8 weeks journey was when I was deported.
And you also have a younger sister who's probably looking up to you as the example, and you probably felt like I got to be strong for her to set the example for her. Is that right?
Yes, yes, definitely. And I think, you know, the toughest part, I would say, of the whole journey was the night I got deported to Guatemala. I was already in Mexico, and I was taken out of the bus by an immigration officer, and they deported me with two of my companions, but my sister wasn't, and she and I got separated.
And that separation lasted how long?
That lasted about a week.
That's got to just rip your heart out, too.
It was really hard. Every time I think about it, every time I read about it in my book, it's hard for me not to cry, because I remember how lonely I felt and the desperation of not knowing if I was going to see her again and not knowing where they were going to take me and all the danger that I was facing, but the things that were happening, you know, I was put in jail. I was starving. I was tired. I was lonely. I didn't know where to go. I only had $20 inside my bra that I was protecting since the day I left Honduras. And I knew that I can probably have breakfast and make a call to the U.S., but other than that, I really didn't know how I was going to make it back to my sister.
What do you call the traveling group that you were with? You just mentioned it real quick. What's it called again?
I guess we were a group of mojados.
Okay.
We were just a group of people that we didn't know each other. You know, when my sister and I left our hometown, and all of a sudden it's a bigger group than us. It wasn't just her and me. It was other people that were coming from different parts of Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. It was very unique because we didn't know each other, but then we got to know each other really fast.
Now, it's and all is not easy in that group either, because you mentioned in your book some of the corruption that kind of happened in that group and with some of the leaders there. Do you want to say anything about that, just to give people an idea about kind of what's going on internally while you're trying to get through a couple of different countries to the U.S.?
Yes. So, you know, we were crossed by a coyota. A coyota is a female form of what most people will know, a coyote. So it was a coyota. And a lot of the things that happen is that you have to hide, you have to go around immigration points. You are somebody who are, you know, I was a teenager, but I was in the eyes of Mexico and the eyes of Guatemala. I was a bad person. You know, I was, I would say they could even call me a drug dealer, or they could say I'm just a person trying to sneak through or trying to do bad things. So we would try to hide from people and hide from immigration. And a lot of those times, our coyota, for example, who was not a very nice person, she would lie to people. She would try to get her way. And that put us in a lot of times in danger.
Didn't she also ask for money repeatedly from your family, saying that, hey, we need more money here in order to, you know, to keep on this journey, et cetera?
Yes, she would. I remember the first time she asked us, please leave your stuff behind. Just take a few things. We don't want to, you know, we don't want people to notice that you are, you know, coming undocumented. And she didn't want us to carry our book back. So we left most of her stuff in this old house that wasn't even finished yet, and she will tell us I'll come for it, and then she never did. So I lost my comfy warm sweater that, you know, during the beginning of the trip, and then I lost like my shoes eventually, and then she would call our family members to the U.S. and ask for money because we needed clothing, we needed shoes, but it was just a way to get more money out of them.
See, that's just doubly hard. That's amazing to me. One of the things that I was impressed with when I read your book was the amount of detail you put in there. I mean, you're a tall, slender, attractive 15-year-old girl with a younger sister who's a year younger, and you guys are like the two perfect people to steal and kidnap and like put you in like the sex trade or whatever goes on. You know, I mean, you could be a very hot commodity, right? As you're traveling as teenage girls to get up to the United States. You talked about, you know, how everything from, you know, feminine hygiene issues to a little romance you had along the way and, you know, everything and everything that, you know, times when you felt warm and times where you felt cold. And I just thought, how in the world did she remember all of these details? How did you remember, or did you keep a journal of all this stuff while you were doing this?
You know, I wish I had, and I remember coming through Guatemala and Mexico. I remember wishing that I had my camera. I'm a photographer, but I started photographing with a small Kodak $10 camera since I was 13, and I always had a way of seeing the world, and I always kind of took a lot of detail when I capture a photo, either with my camera or my eyes. And I would say that I'm very blessed to have a really good memory. And also, I started journaling since I was 11. And studies show that when you journal, your memory gets better with time. And then you become this, you know, person to remember all the details. So I was actually impressed, too, even though I wrote in my journals when I was young. When I was writing Mojada, I didn't look at my journal. I didn't want to. The trip as a Mojada, I never wrote it. Mojada, my trip as a Mojada was something that I never would have to talk to anyone, because that's something that you never tell people, you know, how you came to this country. So I never took the time to write it, even after the fact, or tell my friends or anybody who met me. So I just want to say that that was a blessing for me. And also, as I wrote Mojada, I remember spending hours at night. Also, I feel like my memory was a muscle, and the harder I worked it, the more I remembered. And then I started remembering details that I didn't know that I had in my head.
That's a great comment about your memory being a muscle, and that the more you exercise it, the stronger and the better it gets. That's a brilliant comment. Tell me, what role did the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints play in your journey to America?
When I joined the church at 15, a few months before I came to the U.S., I remember feeling that connection to God, Heavenly Father, that connection that I already had since my grandmother raised me Catholic. I knew God. I knew how to pray. But when I was baptized, I felt closer to Heavenly Father than ever. And what kept me going through that journey as a Mojada in Guatemala and Mexico was prayers. Prayers were my best friend. And even on those lonely nights that I didn't know how I was going to make it, I just had this feeling that I was going to make it. And I remember thinking the night I was deported, Heavenly Father, I ask you to protect me. I ask you to not let anything bad happen to me. And prayers were the only thing that I had, and that connection with God was the only thing I had. And I remember praying and asking for Him to help me. And, you know, it didn't mean that I didn't have to go through those hard parts. I still had, you know, I was still deported. I was still put in prison. I was still in danger with so many bad people around me. But He also put really good people in front of me, and He sent angels, human angels, that came to the rescue and offered me a ride and a plate of food in a hotel. And I just felt like prayers were the only thing that were going to help me make it. And I tried very hard from the moment I left Honduras to pray almost every hour. And sometimes my prayers were last hours. And when I left one place to another, I prayed and I continued to pray until I made it to the next place.
You need to write a book on prayer. That's a brilliant story. Regardless of what your religion is, or even if you're religious or not, regardless of your situation, God is always there. to help you out, right?
And you know what? I wish I was still like that 15-year-old Kayla when I left Honduras, because sometimes at this point in my life, I forget to pray, and I forget that I should ask for everything, and I should ask for protection. But, you know, we are in the process of learning, and, and
yeah,
we're
right,
getting perfect,
right.
But...
Right.
It would be a good book for me too. Now as an adult.
Yeah. and when things get tough, people tend to turn to God. And when things get easy, they tend to kind of forget a little bit, and we're busy doing other stuff, right? And so, I think that's a wonderful statement that you made. Tell us about speaking of wonderful, tell us about your grandmother, who I know played a significant role in your life.
Yes, she's my hero. She's the heroine of my hero of my book. My grandmother raised me since my mother died. I was 3 years old when my mom passed away of ovarian cancer. She passed away at the age of 26, and my sister, who was 2 at the time, and my brother, who was 9, were orphaned by mother and father as well. My grandmother plays that role, took that role as a father and mother and grandmother as well. And she raised me with so much love and protected me and cared about me and taught me things that I didn't know. She was teaching me by example. It wasn't until I actually wrote the book 4 years ago that I understood how important it was to be raised by her. And I wouldn't change it for anything. You know, when I was little, I used to cry when I went to bed. I used to cry and ask God, why did my mother die and why wasn't my father around? And I felt this loneliness, and, you know, I connected with my father many years later. And now in my life, I understand that my father wasn't supposed to raise me. And even my mother was not supposed to raise me. It was my grandmother who played that important role, and I became the woman that I am because of her example. She never, you know, made me clean the dishes or do things at home. She would never tell me what to do or not to do. She was just an example of love and just had a caring heart and an example of kindness. And everyone in my neighborhood loved her, and everyone who remembers her until this day remember her always with a smile, and they love her, and they talk amazing things about her.
That's a wonderful tribute to her, and I'm sure she's smiling looking down on you right now. She probably would say the same about you, and what a joy it was from her standpoint to be able to raise you. I think that's wonderful. Did you have your 16th birthday while you were on this journey?
I did. It was one of the hardest, you know, second hardest nights of my life.
Okay, so that's the next thing. We'll do the tough stuff real quick, and then it will get better. Tell everybody about your 16th birthday. That's a big birthday for anybody, but you had it while you were trying to get to freedom, right? Tell everybody about that.
Yes. When I left Honduras, I thought, you know, I'm going to make it before 16 to the U.S. because this trip was only supposed to last 12 days. Even 14 at the latest, and I didn't have my big 15th birthday, my quinceañera, in Honduras. And I thought, oh, in the U.S., they celebrate this sweet 16, which is the same as the sweet 15, and I was so excited to make it to the U.S. with my family, and I dream of being here with them celebrating. And then, you know, we were stuck in this ranch, old ranch, in the border between Guatemala and Mexico. And I felt so lonely. And that night, I was so embarrassed to cry in front of everyone, in front of the group. But I just didn't care. And I just started crying and crying. And I felt so lonely. And I was just praying, because we had been there for 7 days waiting to get moved to the next place. And I was just desperate. And Heavenly Father heard my prayers, and the following morning after my birthday, we moved to the next location, and that gave me hope, because I knew that every step I took, it got me closer to my goal.
That's an amazing story. I'm just in awe of it. I think your book's fabulous, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. I can only imagine what it would be like to be in your shoes, but we're going to take a break here for another minute. And Kayla, if you got another few minutes to talk to us, I'd love to just keep talking to you some more about your experience and,
and some of the really good stuff here that you also want to talk about and that we should talk about. So I'm talking to Kayla Sanders, who has an amazing book out called Mojada, M-O-J-A-D-A, and we're talking about her journey as a 15-year-old girl from Honduras to the United States to have a better life, and I'm here to tell you she did it, and it's an amazing story. So you're listening to the Junk Refund Show. Hang on for another minute. We'll come back and spend another 20 minutes talking to this amazing lady and some of the amazing things that she has done. We'll be back in just a moment.
Have you ever hired one of those expensive junk removal companies, then wondered what they did with the stuff? Especially the good stuff. At 1-800-JUNK-REFUND, we junk the junk. Recycle stuff like metal and wire. Donate items and get you receipts. And put up for sale the good stuff. And if it sells, you get some money back. Cynthia paid $375 for junk removal and got $3,200 back. Would you like to know how she did it? Tune in to the Junk Refund Show with your host, Alan J. Cook, every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time to get the junk not only out of your home, but also out of your life.
Hey, welcome back to the Junk Refund Show. I'm here with Kayla Sanders, who wrote a book called Mojada about the story of her as a 15-year-old girl and her 14-year-old sister who took a two-month journey. I think it's 1,600 miles, I figured out one time. I think that's right. From Honduras. Right? I did, yeah. Through Guatemala, through Mexico, and up to, is it Brownsville, Texas? Is that where you crossed the border?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And went on to do some amazing things. What do you like most about being a U.S. citizen?
I love the freedom. I feel free. I never thought that there was this weight. I never realized that I had this weight inside of me, in my soul, in my mind, that was pulling me down as I crossed undocumented. And I lived in the U.S. for so many years undocumented. My dream was to, you know, have a way to travel and to work and to go to school. So I was okay. You know, my hope at that time was to have a green card, and that was good enough for me. And it wasn't until way later in life that out of necessity and out of, you know, being afraid of being deported, even with a green card, that I decided I need to become a U.S. citizen because I am part of this country. This country is part of me. My kids were born here. I married a U.S. citizen. And I remember my husband pushed me to become a U.S. citizen, even though it wasn't my priority. And when I became a U.S. citizen and when I took the oath at the ceremony, I remembered a heavy lift that was pulled from my soul. And I remember feeling free and feeling for the first time since I left Honduras that I was free to do and dream and achieve anything that I had desired.
That's really well said. And from the time that you left your hometown in Honduras until the time that you took the oath, how long was that?
That was about 19 years.
19 years. And I think you mentioned to me one time when we were over at a friend's house and you were just kicking off the book that the real journey, the real challenge started once you got to the U.S. Did I say that right?
You are correct. When I left Honduras, you know, I was 15. I didn't know any better about life. I had no idea how dangerous the journey would be. I saw that making it to the U.S. was the hardest part. And then once I made it, in my mind, this was a country of wealth. This was a country of opportunities. I thought that I could study. I could go to school. I could go to college. I could get a job. I could be whoever I wanted. And then when I made it, I realized that it wasn't as easy. First, I had to learn the language, which I was very excited about because I always wanted to speak English. And I was struck by the life that my family had and how hard they worked and how hard they earned their money I had no idea that their lives, you know, that they were part of that category of poor. And it was a shock to me, and also the doors that were closed on my face because I didn't have documents. I was fired from jobs, and I was denied the opportunity of scholarships, and I was denied the opportunity to go to college because I didn't have a green card. And that really got me down, got me depressed. And I realized that it wasn't as easy as I one day hoped it would be.
So it wasn't a bed of roses once you finally got here, which is probably pretty discouraging. You'd think, oh, this is great, the tough part's over. But I know you guys had to go back to Honduras for a little while, and I know Mark went with you and your son, wonderful son Isaac and everything. It's just a remarkable story. Tell everybody how you met your wonderful husband, Mark.
I met him at church at a state conference. I was 18 years old. I had just graduated from high school, and he was still in college. We met at the state conference. I was driving my brother's car, and he broke down. I won't tell you the whole story because you guys need to read the book, but it was it wasn't like very special. Like, I thought, oh, this is going to be my husband. Not at all. I just thought, oh, this is a handsome man, and I'm going to have to introduce him to my cousin. But that's how I met him. And then we met again at a couple weeks later at a singles, you know, conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then I was able to say hi to him again. He didn't know who I was. He had forgotten, you know, because I looked very different according to him. My hair was different, my clothing. And then we just became really good friends, and he had this amazing energy. And then, you know, 10 months later, we got married.
That's amazing. And he speaks Spanish, right?
He does. He actually, at that time, I had only lived in the U.S. for 2.5 years. I was bilingual, but I was so embarrassed of speaking. I didn't want to make any mistakes. And his Spanish was so awesome. He was so perfect. And that I was embarrassed to speak English to him. And so we only spoke Spanish. And we connected really well. He was not just a handsome guy, but he was very kind and very caring.
That's wonderful. Now, tell everybody, you were recently honored as one of the top, and you correct me if I say this wrong, one of the top 50 Latinos in the Washington, D.C. area. Can you just tell us more about that?
Yes, I was nominated as a notable writer, author in the D.C. area, and, you know, and it was an honor, and I wasn't expecting it. A lot of people talk great things about me, and they nominated me. They recognized everything I've been doing with the book, and I was able to receive this wonderful trophy. I never gotten a trophy in my life, so that was the first time
for
me.
That's cool. That's cool. You got
like,
one.
Okay.
That's nice.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, this is how he feels. It was wonderful, and it was wonderful also to be able to represent the Latino community and the undocumented immigrants that have come to the U.S. in so many ways. And it was an honor. It was really wonderful, and I don't know what else to say.
That's perfect. You deserve that. And you were recently on the cover of a new magazine, correct? Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, yes. I was invited to be the cover of the new magazine. It's called Musa Magazine, which is translated news. And this magazine is especially for women. It's a bilingual magazine, and they have amazing topics about women and their lives and how you can grow and you can help others. And I was invited to be the cover because they wanted to find someone who was an example to other women, an example of achievement, an example that, you know, I could do that. If she did it, you know, I can do it. So I was very honored to be on the cover, and it was so special. They had the soft opening a couple weeks ago, and it was very amazing. I wasn't expecting it, but when I was there, everyone wanted to take photos with me. And I'm like, wait a minute, am I famous?
Yeah. You're a celebrity. Good for you.
I am like, how did this happen? But it was nice. People were very kind. And the most important thing that I love about these events and the opportunities is that I get to connect with people, and a lot of people that have come as mojados, as mojadas like me, they tell me their stories and they talk to me. They talk to me about how they feel identified because of me.
Suppose there's a 15-year-old girl in Honduras right now or some other country listening to this program who also wants to do what you did. Do you have a couple of bits of advice of one of the first two or three things of advice that you would give her?
No, I would say that the journey as a mojada is going to be hard to prepare her mentally, emotionally, if this is something that she wishes to do. If I could go back and speak to my 15-year-old self, I will tell her the journey just started, but the hardest part is going to be when you arrive. And you have to be strong, and you will do fine. Just do your best. Everything will be fine, and everything will work out.
I think that's a great summary for all of us when you tell people just do your best, because that's all anybody can do is your best, right? And yeah. You give it your best shot. That's as good as you can't do any better than that. That's as good as you can do, and I think that's really timely advice. So here's one for you. If they put you in charge of U.S. immigration policy tomorrow and you could call all the shots, what's the first thing you would change?
You know, I have been asked, that question in different ways many times. And I want to say it very clearly, right? I wrote Mojada, and it's not a political book. It's my story. It's my story as an undocumented immigrant who crossed the border to achieve dreams. And I wanted through Mojada to give the human side, the story from the human side of what undocumented immigrants have to bust through and their big dreams. And the system is definitely broken. The immigration system doesn't work. And I want to give you an example, right? Because I can only talk about life experiences here. And one of them is that my sister and I came together. We were a year and a half apart. I crossed a month after my 16th birthday. But because I crossed after my 16th birthday, my sister and I have very different endings on our story as, in our journey to become legalized. And my sister was granted political asylum, but it wasn't. And I had to go through this journey of going back to my country. Like you mentioned earlier, I had to go back with my husband, my son, who was one. And I had to live there for a year and a half, wait for my visa. But in the immigration system, that is not fair that, two sisters who come from the same mother, the same life, have very two different results. As an undocumented immigrant, when you come to the U.S., you are denied the access of working, but you are granted a tax ID number so that you can pay taxes on the money that you're not supposed to earn. So for me, we, in this world right now, the changes need to happen because not doing anything is hurting the lives of many undocumented immigrants and other immigrants, no matter how you came, no matter if you came by airplane or what country you're from. We're here really trying to achieve our dreams, and we're not very different from the people who were born here. We're all trying our best, and we're trying to take care of our families and have a better life. And giving the chance to my sister to be legalized, to have opportunities to study, which she did after she got her green card, that was an amazing opportunity for her because she was able to apply for student loans and financial aid to be able to study and work. But it wasn't. I was denied. So definitely something needs to be done where we create a system that works and a system that gives a path to those who are doing great, who are building this country, who are doing amazing things for the community.
That's really well said, too. I just love hearing you tell your story and giving your perspective. Have you ever been happier in your life than you are right now?
I know that I've been posting a lot on social media lately, and like you mentioned, right, I got this new trophy, and I was the cover of a magazine, and I think a lot of times we think that success comes because you're famous or because you have money, or happiness comes because of money. And, you know, my happiness, I can tell you that this week is a great week. 2 weeks ago wasn't. And every day.
That's a good point. Yeah.
You know, every day I really try to get up and just say, this is going to be a wonderful day. And sometimes I'm very optimistic and I can be happy. And some days I can't. I also suffer from depression. It's something I talk in the book about, you know, my depression and where this comes from, and also the journey as an undocumented immigrant, and also the journey as a mom suffering postpartum depression. So for me, there are days where they're good and there are days that I feel like I can't. So definitely I have had amazing years. I have had amazing weeks. And I've had amazing or bad years and bad days and bad weeks. So, but every day I'm trying my best to be happy, regardless of what goes around me, because I realize that happiness comes from within.
Good point. Is there anything you want to say about your awesome husband, Mark, for the role that he's played in helping you along this journey?
He has been an amazing support. The best person that I could have asked to Heavenly Father. I don't believe that there are coincidences in the world. I feel like Heavenly Father put him in my life to be my companion and to help me throughout my life. In the journey, you know, being lonely is one of the hardest things that I think a human can face. And when my grandmother died, right after I met Mark, I was telling him this week, I feel like Heavenly Father and my grandma somehow knew that when she died, I wouldn't be alone. And he has played an important part of my life. You know, he's an amazing father, but he also has been an amazing support throughout Mojada. I told him today, you have no idea. Like, you have all these amazing talents that have helped me. You helped me prepare my talks. You have helped me with the translation to make it sound like I am the one speaking from the heart. You are fixing the little details. You are on top of things that I can't do because I don't have or your talents or the education that you have gotten. So I'm just very grateful for everything he does and for the support that he is, that he has been for almost 20 years since I married him.
You know, he has such a kind heart. He has such a sweet spirit about him that he teaches a class that I sit in on at church, and he'll sometimes get a little bit emotional because he's talking about stuff that really means a lot to him. He is such a humble, wonderful guy that has the sweetest spirit about him. I just think you landed a great one when you and Mark came together. He needs to, you know, you need to write a book about prayer. He needs to write a book called How to Love and Support Your Wife. And
I will let you know.
And you tell him I'll write the foreword to it, but you should write the foreword to it because you know better than I do about how he does that. And it's been so much fun talking to you here. We got just a couple minutes left. I just wanted to say, is there anything that you'd like to talk about on the show that we haven't discussed already that's important to you?
You know, one of the things that I realized as I wrote Mojada is that a lot of people have a dream of writing a book, and I've heard a lot of people talk about it. And I remember when I wrote Mojada and I was afraid of publishing a book that talk about my life, but I remember the feeling of happiness, but also I got to know myself better. I discovered who I really was, and I could see how Heavenly Father made me since I was a little girl. And when someone comes to me and says, I want to write a book, I tell them, go ahead and do it. You know, even if you decide that you don't want to publish it, you should write your own book. You should write those details of your life, even the ones that hurt. It was a therapeutic for me. It's a process of healing that I'm facing at this stage of my life. So I would encourage people to do it. And also, I think I forgot to mention that, you know, you asked me at the beginning about Mojada. Why did I choose that topic? You know, even though it was, it's a name that is given to the migration people, the humans that cross. I want to mention that the name was mentioned in 1920 in the New York Times for the first time, Mojado. People were named wetbacks at that time as a nickname for those who crossed the river from Matamoros, Mexico to Brownsville, Texas. And they would put these inner tubes, and people would get on them with their backs, you know, like their backs, like sitting, and the people on the other side would pull them through the river, and their backs would get wet. Right. And that's where the name comes from. And so that's why they came up with this nasty nickname of wet backs. But in our community, I want to say that Mojados is not a name we use to insult. It's a name we use to describe the way we came to the U.S. And I wanted to take the opportunity to say that I am not embarrassed to say that I am Mojada. I am actually proud of saying that I am Mojada, that I am wet, because it's what has made me who I am, and it's the journey that I had to face, the journey that Heavenly Father put in my life so that I could become the person that I am. And I want to tell people that Mojada, you will not insult me, and you shouldn't use it to insult anyone, because it's just, it. You will, as you read Mojada, you will find out where immigrants who have these big dreams come from. And I, right now, as I think for, you know, the word Mojada, to me, is an honor, and it's a way of saying, wow, she was so courageous, or he was so courageous of coming that way, because a lot of people don't have even the idea of how somebody can make it that way. And I want to say that we are here to make our lives better, no matter if your great-grandparents immigrated from their country, and you are the lucky one to be born here, or your parents were the ones who pay the price for you. We all came in different ways to this country to make it better. And I want to say that I am very proud of the work that my brothers and sisters have done in this country to build it, to erect buildings, to babysit for U.S. citizens, to make this country better. And I also want to mention, now that the bridge in Baltimore was destroyed this week, six of the men that died this week building this country, fixing holes in the bridge, died. And one of them was from Honduras. He was from my country. And he was here undocumented for over 20 years. And he was there at 1 o'clock in the morning working really hard, trying to, I'm sure, work to pay bills for his family to support them. And now he's gone. And five of all those men are from Guatemala and El Salvador. And to me, that is a representation of what Latinos and undocumented immigrants do. We really, the majority of us, come here to work and to build this country and to build an amazing community. And I'm so grateful for them. I'm so sorry for their families and the loss that they're facing. And this is why I wrote Mojada, because I want people to know who we are and what we are. And we are sons and daughters of God. And in whatever way, and no matter how you came, we are all Mojados, because we shed tears and we are all trying to do our best.
That is really well said. And I'm not going to try to add to it, because that was just beautifully said. Thank you to Kayla Sanders for her insight, her life, her courage, etc. everything that she's done. Her book is Mojada, M-O-J-A-D-A. I've read it. I'm telling you, go get a copy and read it. And God bless you, Kayla, and your wonderful family for everything you're doing. And I'm just really thrilled that you had the time to be on the show, and you couldn't have done a better job. It's just been a joy to listen to your insights. And thank you for mentioning the Francis Scott Key Bridge and giving us some insights that I didn't know about that. And I really appreciate it. I God bless you for everything you're doing. I don't know how else to say it any better, but thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you for the opportunity, for listening to my story and for reading my book, for all the support. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate the support of all of those who have purchased Mojada. And, you know, you can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart. You can just Google Mojada and you can buy it from your favorite store. You can also buy it in Kindle form, or you can get a signed copy from me if you go to KaylaSanders.com.
Beautiful. Tell your husband Mark he's a stud, will you?
I will. I will tell him. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Kayla.
So much.
We'll see you soon. It was a blast. Have a great afternoon. We're glad you're in this country. This country's better because you're here. Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. All right. Folks, I can't sum it up any better than that. Thanks for listening to the Junk Refund Show, and thanks to Dawn, our great producer, and to BBS Radio. I'm out of here. I got a plane to catch in an hour and a half to go to Beverly Hills to do a junk removal job. So we'll talk to you soon. We'll see you next Thursday at 3 o'clock on the Junk Refund Show, and get Kayla Sanders' book, Mojada. You can thank me later. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Junk Refund Show, the longest-running junk removal radio show on the air. Join us next week as we discuss innovative ways to declutter your home, your business, and your life using 20 years of junk removal experience. Find out why we give out free ice cream gift cards to our clients, too. In upcoming shows, we will explore how to get the junk out of your relationships, your spiritual life, your waistline, even your travel life. Plus, call in with questions and situations you would like some help with. At 1-800-JUNK-REFUND, we are committed to bringing the next generation of junk removal, because not all junk is junk. See you next week on the Junk Refund Show, every Thursday afternoons at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on BBS Radio TV.